At this time, I would like to introduce our moderator, Carl Gustafson. Carl is a researcher at the Army Engineer Research and Development Center in Vicksburg, Mississippi. He is stationed at U.S. EPA Superfund headquarters, where he provides technical support and site-specific response on technical issues in contaminated sediment characterization, effects assessment, monitoring, and remediation. His current research interests include improving procedures for documenting remedial effectiveness and novel methods to monitor contaminant bioaccumulation in fish. Carl?
Well, thanks, Justin. Thanks for the introduction and the invitation to moderate. And, of course, thanks to all the folks that are on the phone attending this webinar. I think that the large number of people that are attending really helps to indicate the importance of this topic. You know, as we've learned over the last number of years from several experiences, contaminated sediment remediation is an evolving science, and we continue to learn from those experiences. And we've seen a greater focus on remedy effectiveness and increased monitoring at the sites, and that's helped to indicate the types of environmental conditions that are more or less conducive for various remedial approaches and the impact that those approaches have on our receptors of concern, the things that we're remediating to protect. And that increased focus has in turn demonstrated that we have a need for additional approaches that are going to be able to improve or augment the small number of tools that we have in our toolbox for remediation. So it's been exciting to see the increased research and use of reactive amendments. This is what we're going to be discussing today in the two presentations. And we're going to be following this in the future as well, both at Army ERDC as well as EPA Superfund headquarters, because it's a topic and a research component that shows increased opportunity and capability to improve our situation. So, in addition, I think that it's important to note that the field is real lucky that NIEHS, the Superfund research program, has chosen to fund this field, the field of contaminated sediment remediation. There are a few funding mechanisms for this type of work, and there's been a lot of top-notch important research in contaminated sediments that's come out. So we're excited and grateful for that. And today we're going to hear from two of the SRP's grantees, Dr. Peggy O'Day and Dr. Tom Sheehan. Dr. Peggy O'Day is going to be first. Dr. O'Day is a professor and a founding faculty member at the University of California in Merced. She received her BS from California Davis and her MS from Cornell University and her PhD from Stanford University. She was a faculty member at Arizona State University before joining UC Merced in 2003. Her current research is on field laboratory and modeling studies of inorganic environmental contaminants in remediation, with a particular emphasis on arsenic, mercury, uranium, and the application of spectroscopic techniques for their speciation distribution, availability, and reactivity in natural and impacted environments. So, Dr. O'Day, if you could please proceed.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of our research with you and to hopefully get some people interested in using reactive amendments for remediation, particularly with respect to metal and metalloid contaminants. So if everybody's on slide 3, I'd like to start by acknowledging the people who've really done the work for some of the things I'll talk about today. My two postdocs, Susanna Serrano and Virginia Yara, have been responsible for most of the data that I'll show you today, and currently being assisted by graduate student Tom Stilson and undergraduates Adam Mazzotti and Rachel Slick. My co-PI on my Superfund Research Program grant is Dimitri Vasopoulos, currently with Anchor QEA in Portland, and he's been assisted by Brad Bessinger at SS Papadopoulos. So in addition to acknowledging NIEHS and the Superfund Research Program, I'd also like to thank Stanford Synchrotron Radiation Light Source, which is funded by U.S. Department of Energy, where we do most of our synchrotron work. On slide four is a short outline of the talk. This is pretty much going to be something of an overview. I suspect that maybe not many people are very familiar with reactive amendments, particularly for metal sequestration, because they haven't been used as much as I think that they could be. So I'll give the first part of the talk will be some overview related to motivation and background, different types of amendments and sequestration mechanisms. In the second part of the talk, I'll briefly describe some research highlights from our lab and then summarize some future opportunities and challenges in this area. Okay, if you go to slide five, here's just a summary for why we might be interested in developing new technologies and applications related to reactive amendments. There's a number of problematic metal and metalloid contaminants at Superfund and other contaminated sites that have become problematic because they pose a persistent hazard at low concentrations. At many sites, high source area concentrations are often removed, but the residual that's left behind is still considered hazardous, and it's not very easy to remediate because it's often widespread and particularly difficult in the subaqueous or subsurface environments. Many of these different metals and metalloids don't have conservative chemical behavior. So you can't assume that the behavior of copper, for example, is going to be similar to the behavior of arsenic. So we need to know something about the contaminant behavior in the environment, which of course also relates to its toxicity and bioavailability. These things are element specific. And of course, because these are elements, they're not biodegradable. So other than source removal, we don't have a whole lot of other options. And so there's interest in developing in situ technologies that may be appropriate for immobilizing these kinds of contaminants. If you go to slide six, I have a couple of slides here just to give you a little bit of historical background on what's been done at Superfund sites so far. So on slide six, this is just an example from the 2007 U.S. EPA report on NPL site remediation from 1982 to 2005. On the left-hand side of the pie is a summary of ex situ technologies that have been applied for source control. On the right side of the pie are in situ technologies. And I've simply highlighted the percentage of sites where they've actually used solidification or stabilization, which is how EPA classifies reactive amendment type treatments in their reports. And as you can see, this kind of remediation technology really hasn't been applied very much. Particularly in the in-situ case, solidification, stabilization, and chemical treatments have constituted only a small percentage of total remediation or of use at sites for remediation since in 1982. And if you look more closely at these reports, you find that solidification, stabilization, and some of these chemical treatments have really what's been used for metals and metalloids. Many of the other treatments have been applied to organic contaminants. So we think that there's quite a bit of room here to expand this technology and use it to try to solve some of these more problematic contaminant issues. The next slide, number seven, is another example taken from a Superfund remedy report. This is the 2010 U.S. EPA report. This is a summary pertaining specifically to groundwater remedies at NPL sites since 1986. And this is simply to point out that there has been a change in the remedial technologies that have been applied. As you can see from the graph, going back to 1986, pump and treat technologies were widely used at NPL sites up through the mid to late 1990s and then began to fall off. This is probably a result of the fact that a lot of the easy problems were taken care of by pump and treat, and what's been left behind have been the more difficult, hard-to-treat problems. Since the late 1990s, there's been a greater variety of things that have been applied to NPL sites, including things like monitored natural attenuation, a variety of in situ technologies, and a little bit of containment technology. The institutional controls and others applies to other types of engineering solutions, which are often applied at sites in conjunction with the other types of treatment. So there's usually a combination of treatments. It doesn't add up to 100%. But note that the in situ treatments, there was a peak kind of around 2002, and things have pretty much leveled off. And if you read through this report, you find that most of the in situ treatments have been applied to organic contaminants, principally in the form of bioremediation, followed by a variety of chemical treatments such as oxidation and ZVI, sparging, things of this sort. What struck me in going through some of these EPA reports is that in the subsurface, groundwater or subaqueous settings, people really have not applied in situ technologies and really haven't exploited very much reactive amendments as a possible technology treatment. So on slide number 8, I've summarized a couple of things that I think are important to consider. First of all, you know, why is it that more of this technology hasn't been applied? What are the barriers? And what is it that we really need to have as criteria if we're going to apply this kind of technology and then try to evaluate whether or not it's actually successful in remediation? So in terms of criteria for effectiveness, I think as the moderator pointed out at the beginning, we really need to be able to demonstrate that there's a sufficient reduction in bioaccessibility and bioavailability. And along with that, a reduction in the potential for remobilization, which is also linked to bioaccessibility and bioavailability. This is a challenge, and as I'll summarize at the end, I think one of the areas where we need some more research and methods to really effectively evaluate whether we're reducing risk. We also have to consider whether or not the treatments that we're using in terms of adding reactive amendments to sediments or soils, whether or not they're having an adverse effect on reestablishing biota or ecosystems. Also, any treatments that we use really have to be resistant to long-term changes in the geochemical or hydrological environment, and they have to be resistant to any bioturbation or other types of microbial alteration or degradation. Basically, we have to try to engineer these treatments so they're going to be stable for a long period of time. And I think we currently don't have a lot of data on long-term viability and stability of reactive amendment treatments. So as I pointed out in the last couple of slides, there hasn't been a lot of use, at least at NPL sites, of this kind of technology. And I think some of the barriers to adoption include regulatory acceptance and the potential for liability. People get nervous when you leave contaminants in place, and I think there needs to be both good research as well as both good engineering to show that these kinds of treatments are going to be effective. Of course, cost is always a consideration, and the use of something that's considered an unproven technology is often not very attractive, and unless you can show that it's cost-effective, again, that might be a deterrent. In addition to demonstrating the viability of these techniques, I think we need improvements in things like our delivery systems, how we're using them at different sites in different ways, and again, this idea that post-emplacement or post-treatment, we need to be able to assess and have assurances that the treatment is effective. Okay, so on slide 9, I want to begin to talk a little bit about some of the molecular scale sequestration mechanisms associated with reactive amendments. We think that this is really important in terms of understanding how to best use reactive amendments in different environmental settings, and then how we might be able to engineer these treatments better to really take advantage of environmental conditions and the contaminant of interest to try to optimize sequestration. So you can't really optimize sequestration unless you have an understanding of what's going on at the molecular scale. And that's where our research has been particularly focused. You can break sequestration mechanisms into two broad categories. At the top, cartoons for surface adsorption, so reactions at surfaces involving either surface adsorption, ion exchange, or potentially surface reduction oxidation kinds of processes. The other broad category is structural incorporation, where you try to get the contaminant of interest into the molecular or chemical structure of a solid phase. This can also take a couple of different forms in terms of co-precipitating things like amorphous phases, such as a ferrihydrite type phase. You can try to precipitate a solid solution, which would be a crystalline phase, where you've substituted your contaminant of interest into the chemical structure. This has been shown to be effective for a contaminant such as lead that is able to substitute into the apatite structure. And another approach is to try to microencapsulate. So you basically may precipitate or molecularly incorporate your contaminant into a microstructure that might then be encapsulated in a larger crystal. There's been some research, of course, on these mechanisms, but maybe not as much as there could be, particularly with respect to the area of structural incorporation. So we think that there's some opportunities for optimization here. And I'd like to point out that this figure and some of the other things I'm going to show in this talk are going to be coming out in a publication that my colleague Dimitri Vassopoulos and I are co-authors on. This should be out next month in a publication called Elements, which is a joint publication among a variety of mineralogical and geochemical societies. But the articles are written for a general science audience. So we'll get a preprint of that posted on the link site as soon as it's available. Okay, on slide 10, here's a little bit more background on different types of reactive amendment treatments that have been in use. As many of you might know, people have been adding things to soils and sediments for a long time. Particularly in the agricultural field, the amendment of soils with lime and biosolids has a long historical record. There's also been a fair amount of research in waste stabilization and encapsulation using cements and vitrification in an ex situ setting from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So there's a fair amount of research that we can draw on from that field. Many of you are probably familiar with different adsorbents for contaminants that have been used widely, such as activated carbon, variety of different clays and zeolites that primarily act as adsorbents of contaminants. We've been investigating some different types of amendment treatments, as have other people. I would say that the phosphate-type apatites have probably received the most attention in terms of understanding of sequestration mechanisms. I'll talk more about Portland-type cements, which is what we've been looking at. But in addition, there's also different types of caustic amendment treatments, carbonates, ferrovalent iron, iron oxides, aluminum oxides, that have the potential for use in different remedial settings. There's also some interest in recycling materials that would be disposed of otherwise, particularly residues like fly ash, other industrial residues or mining residues that may be low enough in their own contaminants to be used as cost-effective amendments for remediation. And I think this could really be a growth field. Something to keep in mind when we're talking about reactive amendment treatments is how to apply them in kind of a holistic way and how to incorporate them with other types of technologies. So toward the end of this talk, I'll briefly mention capping technologies, which is the subject of the second talk. And I think thinking about using reactive amendments in caps, barriers, and together with other kinds of treatments is really an effective way to apply this technology. Okay, on slide 11, here's just a brief summary of Portland-type cements, which I'll give you a couple of research examples of in the next few slides. Portland-type cements are kind of complicated materials. but we think this is a good thing because it allows for flexibility in their application. Basically, they're mixtures of calcium silicates and calcium aluminates that hydrate when you add water to them, and they form a series of hydrated calcium aluminum silicates in addition to things like sulfates, carbonates, depending on how much of, depending on the proportions of different components that you start with. One of the advantages to these kinds of cement treatments is that there's a lot of possibilities for contaminant substitution in solid phases. So that's advantageous. Another thing that's advantageous is that there's been quite a bit of research on them, and there's some good thermodynamic and kinetic databases out there. We've been using the thermodynamic database developed by Lawrence Livermore National Lab on cement phases. The EMPA group in Switzerland has also added to that database, and they also have some good kinetic information. So the two graphs on this slide are a simulation showing the kinetics of product phases as a function of time. What we've been doing is using these databases to try to predict product phases in both laboratory and field experiments, and then we try to do the experiments and see how well the models agree to experimental data. And what's nice about this is you can do some pre-modeling to try to optimize your system as best you can, and then use targeted experiments to verify the results. So it really helps to have a roadmap in terms of thermodynamic and kinetic databases. The next slide, slide 12, is just an example to give you a feeling for what some of these product phases actually look like in terms of molecular structures. One of the primary components of Portland-type cement treatments is ettringite-type phases, and I'll talk more about these in the examples I'm going to show in the next few slides. These are primarily calcium aluminum plus or minus iron sulfate phases. One of the advantages of these types of structures is that there's opportunities to substitute in both the cation site, the calcium site, as well as the anion site, the sulfate site. And the sulfate site is particularly important for some of the more problematic oxyanions, including things like arsenate and borate, because these types of oxyanions are particularly pretty mobile and they're hard to get into solid structures. But there are analogs between the sulfate ettringite type phases, and an example shown here of pharmacosiderite, which is an iron aluminum arsenate phase. And you can see they have structural similarities, and so we try to take advantage of that in order to engineer some structural incorporation. The next slide, 13, is just to briefly mention delivery systems. I think this is actually an area where we could use both more research as well as more opportunities for demonstration projects, because there's a real challenge here in how do we get our reactive amendments in contact with the soils or sediments and in contact with the contaminants of interest. Certainly the easiest approach, which I'll give an example of in the next couple of slides, is direct mixing with surface soils or sediments. That's the easier problem when your contaminants are at the surface. There's been interest in looking at subsurface injection of slurries. So you inject your reactive amendment in a slurry form. It reacts in the subsurface and solidifies. There's also interest in adding these to things like permeable reactive barriers. Things like zero-valent iron have been used pretty widely for those, but we'd like to point out that we can think more creatively and perhaps use some of these other materials, and certainly in reactive caps, there's another opportunity. Emplacement is always a problem, and we have to consider impact on the environment, regardless of whether the emplacement method is a surface mixing, an injection, broadcasting, for example, in a subaqueous setting, or using polymer and textile mats. And the next talk is going to talk more about some of these subaqueous applications in capping settings. But this is certainly an important area that needs more attention. Okay, next slide, 14, I want to briefly give you an example of some of our research results in looking at molecular mechanisms of contaminant sequestration using Portland cement sulfate treatment, in this case for immobilization of arsenic at a contaminated site. This is a site that was in California, adjacent to San Francisco Bay, and in the photo you can see an aerial view of the site. The marsh to the right of the capped area, where it shows the unamended and amended soil, is actually a marsh area in San Francisco Bay. This site was contaminated by arsenic due to a pesticide treatment or pesticide manufacturing facility that operated for many years. There were reactive amendments added in 1992 and 1996, and there's some shots of the surface mixing. These were applied after the highest contaminated soils were removed. There were still residual soil arsenic on the order of about 1,400 to 1,700 milligrams per kilogram in the site that were amended with a combination of cement and iron sulfate treatment. We had an opportunity about 4 or 5 years ago to obtain field samples from the amended soil after it had been there for over 10 years. And then we also obtained unamended soil that we used in a series of laboratory experiments to simulate the amendment treatment and track the reaction progress and the product phases that were formed in order to compare the laboratory with field samples. So on slide 15, is an example of some of the laboratory results. So these were our simulations with the unamended field soil. We added excess arsenic as arsenate at a series of different concentrations. We added both a combination of Portland cement and iron sulfate, as well as only iron sulfate and only Portland cement, and compared the results. And we aged these up to a period of 1 year and tracked the kinetics along the way. So this slide just summarizes the aqueous phase results, and you can see differences in whether the treatment is iron sulfate only, in which the result ends up at a fairly low pH in the treated sediments compared to the control sediments, or in a high pH solution, when you add Portland cement in the lower set of grass. So the point here is simply that arsenic 5 gets removed rapidly in both of these treatments. They end up under a different pH regime in each case. And after a year of aging, analysis of the aqueous concentrations suggests that the concentrations in solution are controlled by the solubility of the solid phases that have precipitated. So we proceeded to characterize the solid phases and the recalcitrance of arsenic in the solid phases. Slide 16 summarizes some of those results. Again, as a function of time, this is analysis now of the solid phases. We did a series of sequential extractions with two chemical extractants, magnesium chloride to target exchangeable arsenic, and ammonium oxalate to target poorly crystalline phases. So these are strictly as operational extractants, but you'll see in the next couple of slides we have structural characterization of the products. You can see from the bar graphs that over a period of 1 year, the residual arsenic that's in the more recalcitrant phases increases a bit. There's very little exchangeable arsenic, particularly in the case of the iron sulfate treatment. And a bit more, and with some variability in the case of the soil treated with Portland cement. So you can get a sense in these plots that most of the arsenic ends up in either recalcitrant or poorly crystalline phases up to 1 year. Not much is exchangeable, but there's certainly variability, which I think points out the usual variability with soils. The next slide shows some characterization. This is slide 17. So this shows characterization of the product phases. We found that in the case of adding both Portland cement and iron sulfate, that we got a series of ettringite-type phases. as predicted from the geochemical modeling. When iron sulfate only was added, we saw production of iron 3 arsenate type phases that we identified as things like angelolite and zeichiite. So basically we're producing both iron sulfate and iron arsenate type phases in the sulfate only treatments. And we're producing predicted cement type phases when we add Portland cement. And we characterize these using both bulk X-ray diffraction as well as micro-focused synchrotron-based X-ray diffraction, which is the data, the purple graph on the bottom of the 2-theta intensity plot. The next slide summarizes some of the X-ray absorption spectroscopy results. So now we wanted to identify where the arsenic was actually going in these product phases. So slide 18 compares the field samples that we obtained from the site to our laboratory experiments. We were able to verify using X-ray absorption spectroscopy that in both the laboratory experiments as well as the field site, that all of the arsenic remained as arsenate, arsenic 5. There was no evidence for reduction to arsenic 3. And the product phases were similar in the case of both the field samples as well as the Portland cement-treated samples, with evidence that arsenic was incorporated into these calcium sulfate arsenate phases. The field samples, remember, had both Portland cement and iron sulfate, so we didn't have a direct comparison with the iron sulfate-only phases. And the final slide associated with this, number 19, summarizes some of the micro-focused X-ray absorption results and X-ray diffraction results. One of the interesting things we found when we actually did the detailed structural characterization was we could identify the bulk phases that were produced in the cement-type treatments, being ettringite-type phases as well as calcite. But when we actually looked at where the arsenate was going, the bulk excess suggested that we were actually getting calcium arsenate-rich domains rather than a true solid solution between arsenate and sulfate. This is something we've seen in other kinds of experiments where we've used X-ray absorption spectroscopy to probe the bonding of the element in question. At a micro scale, what it looks like is that you're actually enriching a domain in a crystal, and we've certainly, through microscopy, identified these ettringite crystals, but it looks like there are actually calcium arsenate-rich domains, but they are associated with the ettringite-type crystals. So to summarize on slide 20, we appear to be getting effective immobilization with these Portland-type cement treatments, with and without sulfate. The arsenic is taken up quickly from solution, and the neophases form quite quickly. If you only have iron arsenate phases, you produce a series of iron sulfate arsenate products. With the addition of cement, we think that we're getting something that might be more akin to a microencapsulation type mechanism. So we see these domains of calcium arsenate rich phases in both the laboratory samples as well as the field samples. And these appear to be effectively sequestering arsenic. Now, one of the things that we're interested in is looking at the stability of these product phases as you start to change the environmental conditions. The site where we took field samples from, as you saw in that photo, was capped and, for the most part, kept pretty dry. So it was kind of an ideal situation. What we're in the process of doing now is investigating the stability of these phases and basically their dissolution rates under more harsh aqueous conditions and as a function of changes in pH and EH. Okay, so to give you just a couple more slides here on some applications, slide 21 is simply a conceptual model for solid aqueous partitioning of mercury. We wanted to try to see whether some of these sulfate amendments, so these Portland cement type plus or minus sulfate treatments might be effective for mercury as well. Mercury has a very complicated chemical behavior and biogeochemical behavior in the environment, which makes it challenging to remediate. But one way to think about mercury remediation is to recognize the fact that it's methylmercury that's produced primarily by microbial sulfate reduction. That's the bioavailable form of mercury, the most bioavailable form of mercury. So if one can intervene in that sulfate reduction process, that's one approach to mitigating or reducing the amount of methylation that's going on. One of the things to be careful about, though, if you're thinking about treatments here, is how much sulfate you really want to add to the system, because if you get to sulfate-reducing conditions, you might certainly increase the amount of methylation before you can precipitate mercury as a solid mercury sulfide. So there's a balance here in terms of the kinetics of sulfate reduction and mercury methylation versus the precipitation of solid mercury sulfide phases that will remove mercury from solution. So just to briefly mention some results of our studies with iron sulfate Portland cement treatments in slide 22. We did a series of laboratory treatments, in this case using quartz and reference clays as simple analogs of sediments in comparison with some natural sediments. We added excess mercury to these and again did a two-step sequential extraction to assess the effectiveness of the reactive amendment treatment. Uptake of the mercury in this case from solution was quite effective, and we saw a very small exchangeable fraction of mercury by the sequential extraction treatments. Notice that there's quite a big difference. If you look at the sediment bar graphs in this slide, there's quite a bit of difference in the treatments depending on whether we're doing seawater or freshwater treatments. So in this case, we actually simulated seawater solution versus a freshwater solution. And you can see that there's significantly more uptake in the case of the seawater cementment plus amendment treatment compared to control samples without any sediment. And so there's, as you'll see in the next slide, there's some differences in your product phases and potentially in the sequestration mechanisms depending on seawater versus freshwater treatments. So in the next slide, 23, again, products of the sulfate cement treatment were in concert with thermodynamic and kinetic predictions. We saw production of ettringite, as well as formation of gypsum, calcite, and calcium silicate hydrate phases. So macroscopically, the main product phases were in agreement with predictions from models. The next slide, 24, summarizes some of the characterizations we've been doing with X-ray absorption spectroscopy. So we got some interesting results in this case that we're still trying to understand completely. We made some reference aluminum ettringite type phases in order to see how the mercury might be sequestered in these sorts of phases. And what we found basically was that the mercury was not really going into the ettringite structure. That's not a big surprise. But in fact, it was being precipitated in a solid phase. So the spectrum there shows you the similarity between a reference calcium aluminate ettringite that was precipitated in the presence of mercury and a sediment treated with cement. You can see the spectra are very similar. And analysis of those spectra suggest that we're getting a local structure that's consistent with mercury bonded to chloride. And this is where the seawater treatment is important. But other evidence that we have from microscopy suggests that this local structure is associated with those ettringite-type phases. So, again, we think we're getting some microencapsulation of what looks like a mercury chloride-type precipitate within ettringite crystals. And we have some new data from X-ray microprobe analysis that's consistent with that interpretation. So this is some of the evidence that we're seeing that suggests that these kinds of microencapsulation mechanisms of sequestration might be quite effective and might be quite important. So to close in the last couple of slides here, slide number 25, We've also been looking at reactive cap technology, which is the subject of the next talk, so I'm not going to say too much about this. We think that capping is a good way to think about treating subaqueous sediments, and we think that capping in conjunction with use of reactive amendments is a profitable way to think about how to enhance the isolation as well as the sequestration of contaminated sediments. So generally, caps involve some kind of clean quartz sand, which may or may not include a reactive layer, such as sulfate cement, or even an adsorbent layer, such as clays or activated carbon. These kinds of applications also allow you to put sediment on the top to reestablish the biota. What we've been looking at in particular is using a reactive transport model to try to model the behavior of caps over a longer term in order to give us some idea of how to optimally design these kinds of caps. So we've developed a reactive transport model for mercury and arsenic. Slide 26 summarizes the components of the mercury reactive transport model. So in this case, we've combined both thermodynamic and kinetic parameters. The kinetic parameter is trying to capture some of the biogeochemical processes that are important for mercury. And we've coupled that in a one-dimensional reactive transport model. So this model includes both equilibrium, homogeneous and heterogeneous speciation, kinetic parameters for simulating iron sulfate reduction as well as denitrification coupled to oxidation of organic carbon. And we've used information from the literature to try to parameterize the mercury methylation rate as it's tied to sulfate reduction. We've also included demethylation. And also another important component is mercury complexation with organic carbon and with sulfide, as well as adsorption to particulate organic matter. So this is a pretty comprehensive model. It allows you to investigate different scenarios. I'm only going to show you one slide about this, but we've done a number of different scenarios that involve both looking at different forms of transport in terms of diffusion as well as advection and diffusion. So slide 27 is a summary of one of the simulations. This particular simulation did not have a reactive layer in it. It was just looking at the behavior in the sand cap. But one of the interesting results here has to do with the amount of organic carbon in the system. So what was done in this particular simulation was a fair amount of total organic carbon was added to the boundary layer at the top of the cap, again, kind of simulating the reestablishment of a biotic layer there. And it turns out that in these simulations that the mercury methylation, of course, is driven by sulfate reduction, but there's a competition between complexation of methylmercury with organic carbon versus precipitation of mercury sulfide as menacinabar. So these simulations, which go out to 100 years, show you that the model predicts that most of the methylmercury ends up being associated with organic carbon in that top layer, whereas lower in the cap you have precipitation of mercury sulfide. So this is an important consideration when we're designing these kinds of treatments, to be able to simulate and hopefully try to parameterize a bit better the kinetics of these different competing processes in order to optimize the cap thickness to get precipitation and not necessarily methylation of the mercury. So in summary on slide 28, I think that there's definitely some opportunities here to think about site-specific design of treatments and of using cements as well as different types of reactive amendment treatments to try to optimize solid solution or encapsulation of contaminants as opposed to simply adsorption. Combining these with things like permeable barriers and caps, along with taking advantage of natural attenuation, can be a very cost-effective way to employ these kinds of technologies and hopefully make them competitive with existing technologies. As I've mentioned, I think one of the big needs here is to have a better understanding of their long-term stability in the environment and to be able to assess whether we're getting real risk reduction over a long term. And I'm hoping that with some of those needs addressed, that there'll be more acceptance on the part of regulatory agencies and industry to try to employ some of these treatments. So thanks for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Dr. O'Day. Appreciate the presentation. Before we start the next one, we're going to take a couple of questions. We're going to take folks on the phone lines first. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing star 6. And before you ask your question, please state your name and your organization. So we'll open it up for questions.
This is Brett Thomas with EPA Region 4. I had a quick question. Just in general, when we're talking about some of these amendments, especially, say, for example, the cement amendments, what is the resulting soil or sediment texture like? Is it something that is inhabitable, or would you need to, as is, or would you have to go ahead then and cap that with something that's more substrate or habitable?
Right. I think that's something that certainly can be engineered a bit. In the example I showed you, that particular site was capped with an asphalt cap, but that isn't absolutely required. In terms of texture, this gets mixed in with the soil. So what you're left with is a soil layer that's not completely uninhabitable, but probably what I think would be an effective treatment would be to, if you're doing a surface mixing, to do a mixing on the surface and then cover with something like a clean soil layer for reestablishment of your biota. Probably in terms of biotic effects, the main consideration might be the final pH of the soil. So if you're using strictly a caustic amendment treatment, it might initially start at fairly high pH, but presumably reestablishment of plants in particular initially are going to start to bring that pH down. You can also, as I showed in the example, mix it with things like iron sulfate to bring your pH down a bit, or if you're thinking about a different kinds of treatment, that's one of the parameters that can be adjusted. So I think there's room to engineer how you want your final outcome. But in general, I think for a lot of these kinds of amendments, you probably want some layer of soil or isolation in order to get the biota to initially reestablish.
All right, thanks.
Additional questions from the phone lines?
Yes, this is Rick Beach with MacTech Engineering. A question regarding the Portland cement studies you were looking at. To your knowledge, and hopefully I didn't miss this, has there been any field applications of these in subaqueous environments, or very many of these yet?
I don't think so. We in fact have been wanting to try one. I think my understanding is they've mostly been used in surface settings. This is why this has been something of a research topic. We think that there is opportunity for subaqueous application if you combine it particularly with things like a capping technology or a geotextile technology. But as far as I know, I'm not sure that I've seen any studies that have really investigated this yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, this is Chris Carbono from AECOM. I just wanted to follow up on that because there's been some pilot work in the Passaic by a company by Edo. It's a Japanese company. They have an application where they do this subaqueous. However, what they do is they surcharge the sediment with a sand cap and then install it beneath that. So they install it kind of like within a shroud. I'm not familiar with any much else that's being done here, but it is being looked at, and they've done it over in Japan.
Maybe the next speaker might talk about this, but I have seen some work where reactive layers have been embedded in, for example, geotextiles, or as layered caps, and that's probably been the closest thing so far.
I have a. Hey. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
I'm Huang Lin from DEP Pennsylvania. And I have questions. The pH of the cement or porcelain or lime is very high, and in industry, for example, steel industry, they use a lot to change the pH of the coal ash from 3.5 to 10, 11.
Right.
The solubility of heavy metal is 10 to minus many times. Okay. DEP Pennsylvania cooperate with Penn State Material Research Institute have published one book in 2004. But I had a proposal in 1999 about the coal ash drop into iron hydroxide. It's a 3-valent and can coat the pore, absorb tremendous iron in the bottom ash. Use this to trap heavy metal, particularly arsenic water. And I proposed in 1999. 2 years later, EPA funded 13 R&D small company for 2 years. Then 2004, Buckley, Lauren Buckley National Lab, one senior scientist picked it up. Within 5 months, he achieved that. Today in Bangladesh, drinking water, a lot of graduate students working there use this cheap method. It's a red hot coal dropped into iron hydroxide. So one question, this is nothing like a geochemistry, okay? But in geochemistry, I have some question about the oxidation reduction and those compound complex leaching, how to interact from element to another element. So form a look like beta seed formation, not easy to leaching out. So we will achieve the immobilization in the ground. So that is my concept of the how to approach the things. But I'm not a physics. I'm not a basic research like that. But that is my comment on this field.
Yeah, well, I mean, you make a good point. A lot of what I've mentioned has certainly been looked at in ex situ cases of mixing cement with contaminants for immobilization, and we've certainly tried to draw from that literature. I think, as you're pointing out, a challenge is how do we adapt this to an in situ kind of treatment that's effective. And how do we make sure that not only contaminants are immobilized, but they're going to stay that way and not change their oxidation state? So this is certainly a challenge, but I think there's a lot of opportunity to do it, because as you're pointing out, there's been quite a bit of research to understand these reactions. I think some of the challenge is making them work in different settings. I don't know if I've answered your question, but I agree with you.
Yeah, it's a very good, very good way to use a nature phenomena, the basic concept. Basically, I got this from galvanic theory concept, basic concept. When I visit the power plant, I reviewed some submitted to EPA one day.
In the interest of time, we're going to have to move on to the next question,
okay.
Please.
All right.
Thank you. This is a question from the web. It says, on slide 16, are the bar graphs indicating that residual arsenic is increasing in samples over time between 30 and 365 days? That's the Richard Pollard of Chartist Law.
Oh, yeah. So on slide 16, the dark bars are residual arsenic that's in the recalcitrant phase. So the light shading is the amount of arsenic that came off in the ammonium oxalate treatment, and the clear bars at the top are the magnesium chloride treatment. Adjacent to each bar where it says total arsenic, we did a separate split where we did a total digestion to ensure that we were getting mass balance between our total arsenic and our extracted one. So the total arsenic is actually a separate split. So you can see we have pretty good mass balance in all of these. And yes, you can see that there's some variability. It looks like we get an increase. This is not all the data, by the way. This is only an example of some of the data. But we do get an increase in recalcitrant arsenic in the first week or so, and then it appears to drop at 30 days, and we're not really quite sure why. We think that there's a change in the macroscopic phases that are going on at around 30 days. You can see that the fraction extracted by ammonium oxalate, which is a poorly crystalline fraction, kind of increases. And then there's a gradual increase from 30 days to 365 days in the arsenic associated with the residual recalcitrant fraction.
Great. Thank you, Dr. O'Day. We will be moving on to the next presenter right now. There were some other questions and comments on the web. Those folks should feel sure that I'm going to forward those on to Dr. O'Day. Dr. O'Day's contact information is also available, and I'm certain she'd be willing to entertain any additional questions or comments on that. And there will be additional time at the end of the seminar, if we have some time, for questions that are going to be open to both presenters. But right now I'm going to move on to Dr. Tom Sheehan. Professor Sheehan is in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northeastern University. He's been on the faculty there since 1991. He's an expert in geotechnical laboratory and field testing, data interpretation, and testing equipment development. He's adapted his expertise to remediation of contaminated subaqueous sediments. He has published over 60 articles, including 30 publications, and is the co-author of a forthcoming book, An Introduction to Geotechnical Engineering, Second Edition. He's nationally active in the Transportation Research Board, and he's served as co-editor of the ASTM Geotechnical Testing Journal. He has several awards, including an Elevation to Fellow at ASCE, the Tau Beta Pi National McDonald Mentoring Award, and Special Service Award for ASTM Committee D18. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Sheehan right now. The presentation will last for approximately 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions. So, Dr. Sheehan, please.
Carl, thanks very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to all of you today about the research that we've been doing here at Northeastern and at the Harvard School of Public Health, which is our research partner on this project, on reactive geocomposite sediment mats, or reactive core mats, as I'm going to be referring to them throughout this presentation. Moving to slide 30, which is the outline of my talk, I'm first going to be introducing you to the concept of a reactive core mat as they apply to subaqueous sediments. And in many ways, Dr. O'Day set me up perfectly for my talk by giving a bit of an introduction to reactive caps. But I think the nature of my talk is going to take a little bit of a different twist as we move through it, because what I'm going to be talking about is the development of a new testing device that we use, because we felt that we needed to gain some fundamental knowledge in how these reactive core mats work. We had to develop protocols for those tests. And then I'm going to go over some research highlights and results in two sets of tests that we've conducted, one on sediments contaminated with PCBs, and I'm going to show you some results from some bioavailability exposure tests that we ran. And then I'm also going to show you another set of results on naphthalene-spiked sediment, and I'm going to show you some results from some water concentration tests that we have performed. I also want to review some modeling efforts that we're making at our end. I know Dr. O'Day talked about some modeling work that she's done. I also want to talk about the work that we're doing here, which is very important in our case because of the bench scale that we're operating at. We're going to need to eventually be able to scale up those results to the field and include both the mechanics resulting from consolidation and advective transport, but also other forms of contaminant transport through diffusion. And then I will wrap up by talking about some future work. So moving on to slide 31, most of you are probably already aware of the conventional aquatic sediment treatments that are normally at your disposal currently. There is the idea of environmental dredging, and what I'm going to be doing is mostly talking about some of the drawbacks of these three conventional methods. And with environmental dredging, we see the potential for significant resuspension, either through leakage of buckets as they remove the material, or simply the disturbance of the sediment as it's being dredged, despite precautions that might be taken. And ultimately, you have to get rid of this material somewhere, so there tends to be a large disposal volume that has to be sent somewhere, usually at great expense and through other permitting difficulties that occur. Dr. O'Day talked about the idea of a geomaterial cap, usually some sort of quartz sand. It may also include an amendment. That's also become quite common. These can pose navigation hazards if they are being put into more shallow waters, and hydrologic conditions can result in some severe erosion potential if they are not carefully monitored. And obviously, there is also the solution of simply natural attenuation, perhaps in combination with these other mechanisms. But as Dr. O'Day has alluded to, these tend to be longer duration. They are only suitable for certain contaminants, and they require favorable environmental conditions in order for them to be effective. So what I want to do is introduce an alternative method, which is the idea of using a reactive core mat for the isolation and partial remediation of these aquatic sediments. You can see a photo, this is on slide 32, you see a photo of a typical reactive core mat, which is essentially a sandwich between, with the outer layers being a non-woven geotextile material that is a filtering layer, and an internal reactive layer that's typically put into some sort of non-woven medium for stability to make sure that it doesn't bunch up, for example, in a section of the mat. And the idea is that this is placed directly on top of the contaminated sediment, and that primarily advection but also diffusion draws the pore fluid and some fine particles through the reactive core mat, and that adsorption and neutralization is intended to occur in that center reactive layer. It is the belief that because most of aquatic sediment contamination occurs in the upper 50 centimeters of that sediment, that this method can be effective in remediating aquatic sediments through this placement. So this is the idea behind the reactive core mat. And on slide 33, on the left-hand side, you see a schematic of how such a reactive core mat would be placed. It's like a big roll of paper towels, essentially, that's rolled out, typically anchored at the ends, and then a layer placed on top of this, typically a sand, and that's really for two purposes. That not only protects and stabilizes the reactive core mat in place, but it can also serve as the basis for the formation of a new biota, a new ecosystem on top of this mat because of the isolation that's being provided. On the right-hand side, you see a photo of an installation of one of these rolls as it's about to be placed. This is actually a photo from the Anacostia River Project, which was a set of pilot projects to test a number of these remediation strategies for subaqueous sediments. On slide 34, I wanted to highlight some advantages of the RCM, the reactive core mat, over traditional caps. They can neutralize, absorb, and isolate contaminants, and while traditional caps can do the isolation part, they typically cannot achieve the neutralization and absorption of the reactive core mat. And I should put potential in front of these because part of our research is to explore the degree to which this can happen. It can also help to prevent the migration of fines, which traditional geomaterial caps will not be able to do effectively. And those fines, which include both mineral and organic particles, often adsorb significant contaminants that they carry with them. And so if those can be prevented from migrating, it further assists with the remediation, the isolation. It does provide that foundation for a new overlying sediment where a new ecosystem can develop. And the last case really speaks to Dr. O'Day's discussion previously, which is that we can target different reactive materials for different contaminants. So we can fill that reactive layer that you see on slide 34 with different reactive materials. In the case that I'm going to be showing you, we used a reactive mat containing organoclay, but there have also been cases shown where zeolite was used as well as other materials in the center for reactivity. So there are some significant advantages to this. And on slide 35, I simply want to state that these have already been used in practice quite a bit. But what I would maintain is that part of the reason our research was motivated is that we believe that there are a number of things that are not very well understood about these reactive core mats. In particular, we really don't know how effective they are in remediating the underlying sediment and isolating it. We really don't know the long-term capacity or the breakthrough capacity of these mats. The RCMs may not be appropriate for all contaminants, depending on their mobility. That certainly is one of the requirements for the RCM, is that they require contaminant mobility to move up through that reactive core if they're going to be effective. And finally, there have not been significant efforts in modeling this process for scalability purposes in order to figure out how this is going to move out to the field in a predictable way based on our benchtop results. So these are really the bullet points for what motivated the research into the RCMs that we conducted. On slide 36, I detail our research approach that I'm going to be talking about. We developed this new benchtop device that I'm going to be describing, including the protocols. And I'm going to talk about the testing that we did to test the efficacy of the reactive mat, the RCM, in terms of its isolation, remediation. And in addition, we ran several bioavailability tests in the overlying sediment that we put on top of the mat, and I'll show you that as we go through. And we also ultimately want to measure the RCM's breakthrough or reactive capacity. That's something that we're in the process of doing now. And then also analytically model that process, as I said, for field scalability. So on slide 37, you see a cross-section very similar to the one that Dr. O'Day showed previously. I was smiling a little bit that hers had very pretty angelfish and other things going on, so I think I must be in a more contaminated waterway because all I have are air bubbles in my waterway here. But this shows you, again, just the physical model of what this would look like out in the field, the contaminated sediment obviously at the bottom, the reactive mat, and as you saw from the photo previously, the scale of that is about a half to three-quarters of an inch thick. It's relatively or very thin compared to a geomaterial cap that is traditionally used. On top of that would typically be put 6 inches of a clean sand for this biogeneration zone where a new ecosystem could potentially develop. And so on slide 38, I show you the device that we developed here at Northeastern to mimic this physical situation. On the left, you see the schematic of this device. This is an acrylic tube, which is 8 inches in diameter and 16 inches high. We put the sediment into the cylinder, lay a section of the reactive mat on top of that. Again, I'm referring to the schematic on the left. Over the reactive mat is a plunger, and you can see the plunger in the photo on the right as it goes through the acrylic tube. That is to apply a surcharge stress that would be equivalent to that which we would find out in the field. Over the plunger is that biogeneration or bioregeneration zone. That's the clean sand that I'll be referring to. And on top of that is the overlying water to represent the water column above it. This device has the ability to apply water pressures on each side of the column in order to back pressure the sediment, and we can also have flow upward or downward flow through the sediment if we so chose to do that. We try to keep the device simple despite the complexity of the photo on the right. This is a deadweight loaded device for the cylinders and also a pulley system that applies that surcharge stress to the plunger. So we tried to be very true to mimicking that physical situation that you saw back on slide 37. So moving to slide 39, and by the way, the acronym that you may be seeing here is the Integrated Contaminated Sediment Testing Apparatus column, which is why it's a lot easier for me to refer to this as the ICSTAC, which is the acronym I'm going to be using for this new device. And here you see how this would look before and after the test. You see that the plunger is going to be pressing down, causing advective flow. There will also be some associated diffusion during this process. And afterwards, you see that the sediment has consolidated. The water has moved up through the sand, through the plunger, into the overlying water. And chemical sampling ports within both the sediment pore fluid and the overlying water allow us to take samples throughout the test and to perform analyses of those water samples. So this is the before and after model of those two of the ICSTAC device testing procedure. Once the test is completed, the sand sample that lies over, and I'm referring to slide 40, the sand sample for overlying the plunger is removed, as well as samples of the RCM and sediment and other things from the test. The sand sample itself is transported to our research partner at the Harvard School of Public Health. And I should mention that the sand is going to be used to expose worms to the sand and the associated breakthrough contaminants, if there are any. We found early on that worms cannot live on sand alone, and we ended up having to mix the sand with an organic food mixture, which you're going to hear me referring to as trout chow, which is the nickname for this organic food mixture. So this sand and trout chow mixture is sent to Harvard School of Public Health. And at that point, referring to slide 41, we start a process of the exposure testing by first having a 14-day incubation period. This 14-day period is to remove toxins from the sand and trout chow mixture, which would be deleterious to the worms. And then at day 15, the worms are added to the sand and trout chow mixtures, and the exposure test occurs for 28 days. So at day 43, after 28 days, the worms are removed, frozen, and acid digested to be processed for chemical analysis. And you can see the worm species there. They are freshwater and deposit feeding worms that are used. So that is the procedure for the ICSTAC test that have been conducted both for PCB, contaminated sediment, and the PAH spiked sediment that I'm going to be showing you. Moving on to slide 42, I just want to show you the location for where we obtained the baseline sediment. This is upstream of an industrial impoundment dam on the Neponset River. We had the cooperation of EPA Region 1 and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, which assisted us in obtaining the sediment from this site. And moving on to slide 43, the PCB tests used the natural sediment without any spiking or amendment, and it was found that the approximate concentration of PCB in the natural sediment from this site was approximately 10 ppm. For the second set of tests, I'm going to be showing you sediment that has been spiked using naphthalene. I'm going to be referring to as PAH. The reason we used naphthalene was because of its higher solubility in water than PCB, We thought this would be a more challenging and robust test of the reactive core mat. But frankly, the other reason was that it would be a lot cheaper for spiking than the PCB would be. And given our budget constraints, that was also an appropriate choice for us to make in terms of spiking the sediment. We also felt that it would be safer to work with in higher concentrations than the PCB was. So again, the pH seemed to be a logical choice for us to move on to after the initial PCB tests were done. In the case of the spiking, we use a 14-day rotational mixing process, and then is immediately transferred into the ICK stack for testing. Moving on to slide 44, I'm going to first be showing you research results from the natural sediment unspiked with the 10 ppm PCB. And I'm going to be showing you data that is both sort of a macro level data, and then I'm going to show you a more advanced analysis method that we're currently using to try to understand those results better. I have to put in the caveat that our data has been difficult to interpret in this case because of the low concentrations. However, I do feel the results we've obtained so far have been fairly meaningful, and I think we're making progress on understanding the PCB results from the ICK-STAC test. Moving to slide 45, as I said, I'd first like to mention the macro level results, and the graph on the left shows PCB concentrations in the sand, and that should say sand and trout chow mixture, both before and after the exposure tests in three of the ICK-STAC tests. This particular graph is merely showing that there is transfer of PCB from the sand trout chow mixture to either the worms or the overlying water. I think the more important graph to point out is the one on the right. The one on the right shows PCB concentrations in the sand and trout chow mixture after the ICK-STAC tests, and what it indicates is that for tests NEP3 through NEP6, which had the RCM placed on them in the ICK-STAC test, it indicates that the PCB concentrations in the overlying sand protected by the RCM are more or less similar to the control sand before any testing was done, before any exposure to chemicals was done. So in other words, the RCM is able to protect that overlying sand and keep it at what amount to background PCB levels that were already in the sand to begin with. On the other hand, NEP7, in which there was no RCM used in the ICK-STAC test as a controlled case, shows that there was considerable PCB breakthrough into the sand and trout chow case, or trout chow area, and we have at least two times the concentration of what we found when the sand and trout chow was protected by the RCM. So that shows you the sort of macro level state of PCB breakthrough in the ICK-STAC test. What I'd like to briefly also show you, though, is that we're finding that this is a little bit more complicated a problem. And because of that, and I am going to explain this graph, but we are using something called principal component analysis, which some of you may be familiar with. What this is allowing us to do is to look at, with 209 congeners and several homolog groups in the PCBs, it's allowing us to take a closer look at which of the PCB congeners are actually moving from the sediment up into the overlying sand and to the worms during the exposure test. Just briefly, principal component analysis, moving on to slide 47, it tends to compress the data without losing information, and it lets us visualize data in a way that helps us understand what's happening in these complex tests with multiple PCB congeners. The best way for me to explain this is that the axes of this plot are essentially virtual axes of components of greatest variance in the chemical analysis. What that does is, again, it compresses the data, it allows us to make comparisons among congeners and also homolog groups within PCB. The other way that I like to explain this, again, on slide 47, is that this is a bit like a dial gauge. that starts in the upper left with the lightest congeners, swings around counterclockwise until we reach over to the heaviest congeners on the other side. It's probably best to move on to slide 49, if I could, to show an example of exactly what I mean. What this shows is that because of where the vectors plot in this PCA space that we've created, if a sample is high in a homolog group H7, it is more likely to be high in homolog group 8 than any other homolog group. That's what the coincidence of those two vectors indicates. It also indicates that samples 6 and 10, which are sand that was taken from the X-stack test, are going to tend to contain homolog groups 7 and 8. Perhaps a more interesting result from this graph also shows that when we look at which PCBs were taken up by the exposed worms, they tend to be coincident or close to coincident with homolog groups 4 and 5 and tend to be in sort of a medium weight congener group that were taken up. Again, we're still trying to analyze and understand the results of this PCA analysis, but what we think it's going to help us with is to understand the partitioning of PCBs as they move through the RCM and whether all PCBs are going to be appropriately remediated by an RCM as opposed to others. Moving on to slide 50, I want to move to the other half of our testing that we have done using spiked sediment using naphthalene. Again, this shows you in slide 50 the process for the spiked sediment testing that we did. We added 250 milligrams of naphthalene per kilogram of dried sediment, and we obtained water samples from the X-stack device, both from the sediment pour fluid below and from the overlying water above throughout the testing. And when I say throughout the testing, I mean as we loaded that plunger and caused the vective flow to occur. We then plotted these concentrations below in the sediment and above in the overlying water, and we normalized those by the initial concentration in the sediment. So moving to slide 51 as an example, you can see that what we've plotted here is the concentration at any time divided by the initial concentration in the sediment pore fluid prior to the start of the test, and we've applied a 10 kPa pressure to the overlying plunger to get the objective flow moving. And I'm showing you four results from this particular pressure level. I'm showing you the case in the upper left where there was only sand and trout shell over the plunger. There was no reactive core mat. Lower left is the sand is sand only, so there was no organic food put into that. Then in the upper right is our reactive core mat, and overlying that would be sand and trout shell, and then overlying water. And then finally, in the lower right, is absolutely no barrier. All there was the plunger placed onto the sediment, and the vective flow was allowed to flow freely into the overlying water. As you can see, at this low pressure, what's happening is we do see a concentration difference between the sediment and the overlying water in all cases, but it's highly variable in all the cases except the reactive core mat, in which you see the overlying water is showing virtually no concentration of PAH throughout the time scale of this particular stress increment. On slide 52, I'm going to progress through the next level of pressure, which was 25 kPa. We continue to induce additional advection. Again, you see the difference in the data between the three cases without the reactive core mat, upper left, lower right, and you again see the effectiveness shown by the reactive core mat, in which the overlying water, again, shows virtually no concentration of PAH at the end of this increment. And then finally, in slide 53, at the highest pressure applied, which is 55 kPa, which I should add is fairly significant overburden pressure for a soft sediment, we see again that the gaps are beginning to close between the sediment and the overlying water. We believe that part of this is due to advection, but also the capacity of sand and trout chow and sand is starting to diminish, starting to let some of the pH through. But in the upper right, you continue to see that the reactive core mat is protecting and isolating the overlying water from the pH concentrations, and it remains virtually flatlined close to zero in that upper right-hand plot. Moving on to slide 54, I'll just briefly mention that we are currently involved in modeling this process. We have completed an initial phase of modeling this process using a small strain consolidation model, which was developed by Fox using a numerical technique. And this includes an advective flux coupled with contaminant transport along with small strain consolidation. It built on some earlier work by myself and my colleague, Akram Al-Shawabke, who's a co-PI on this project. And we have provided some results in the Geotechnical Testing Journal to show how well these agree between our test data and these initial modeling efforts. On slide 54, I show you the phase two of this modeling process, in which we are now using a large strain consolidation model. We're going to become a little more sophisticated in our approach to our chemical reactions. We're going to use a absorption model that we believe is more accurate. And again, we are going to be using an evective flux coupled contaminant transport model that also incorporates the reactive core mat as one element of this model in phase two. We believe this is going to give us a very accurate view of how this will behave in the field and over time so that we will get both spatial and temporal help in predicting what's going to happen out in the field with this model. On slide 56, I wanted to show you where we're headed next with our research. As we saw in some of those concentration plots, we feel that we did not accurately capture the long-term behavior of these reactive core mats through that incremental kind of loading that we were doing in our initial tests. So we're going to run a constant flow column tests on the sediments, both the PCB and the PAH spiked sediment. We're going to use a slightly smaller diameter column, which is good news for us because it means it's less sediment that we'll need to be using. We're going to be sampling from the sampling port shown on slide 56, both within the sediment and in the overlying water, just like we did with the ICSTAC tests. And what we hope this is going to do is give us a much better picture of the breakthrough capacity of the reactive core mat and also model upflow site conditions, which often occur in the field. Slide 57, I want to summarize our research. We have successfully developed what I believe is a good device for fundamentally studying the behavior of these reactive core mats and examining how they will behave in the field, and we developed the protocols to run those tests. We believe that the reactive core mat shows very good naphthalene sequestration, and that the PCB bio-uptake also shows promise, but we need to understand this better because we believe that uptake may be selective and or transformative. That's not clear at this time. We're using the PCA to try to understand that, and we're developing constitutive models that comprehensively model this work. And we think the new column testing device that I just talked about will help further test and validate the reactive core mat capabilities. And that's really where we're headed in future research. So I won't repeat that here. The only thing I'll mention at the end of this slide is that we would ultimately like to do some saltwater testing. We do have access to New Bedford Harbor to do some testing there, and we hope to do bench scale and field scale testing at that site as well. Lastly, I'd just like to, on slide 59, acknowledge the participants in this research, my co-PI Akram Al-Shawabke, my students Doge Merrick, Sarah Barbudo, Mansour Nuri Zirad, and the Harvard School of Public Health partner is Dr. Jim Shine, who some of you may know because he's been very active in the sediments community. And as I said, we've had some great help from EPA Region 1 technical contact, and SETCO has provided some in-kind support through their donation of materials that we're using. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you, and I'll look forward to any questions that you may have.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Sheehan. We appreciate the presentation. I'm going to open it up to questions now. First, we're going to go to the phone lines. If you want to ask a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing star 6. And prior to your question, please state your name and your organization. So I'll open it up now to phone line questions.
I have a question.
Yes, please go ahead.
I'm Carolyn Barley with the District Department of the Environment. You had mentioned the Anacostia River and a model program. Did I miss that? I didn't hear any more about that.
No, that was not part of our project. It was a demonstration project that took place several years ago, and all I did was show a photo of placement of one of these mats during that project.
I see. All right. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
This is Gary Braun with Tetra Tech. You know, in the RCM that you used, what was the reactive material? Was it organic clay or activated carbon?
It was organic clay.
Organic clay. Was there a particular, is that the PM 199 or 200, whatever they use there, you know?
Yeah, it's PM 199.
PM 199, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, and that also addresses one of the web questions that was submitted, which was what is the active material used in the RCM? Any additional phone questions?
It's Annette Padillo from Environmental Quality Board. Does MAC has any times of reactiveness, where the reactiveness or the capacity of working slow downs or doesn't keep on doing the job?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that is the answer. That question is the one we're trying to address with this next phase of testing with this constant flow column, because I think that was one of those things we found as we moved through this initial phase with the first device, that we were not capturing enough of that temporal scale that we really need to look at for breakthrough. So that's what we're looking forward to doing with this next phase, is to understand how will it behave in the long term, and will there be a point where it maximizes its reactivity, which of course it will, and it's just a question of how long that is, and then how does that scale up in terms of its field applicability.
We have several questions from folks on the web. I'm going to ask a couple here for those folks, and then we can move back to questions from the phone lines. The first is from Rich Weber from Natural Resource Technology. The question is, have there been any studies regarding volatilization of contaminants, for example, PCBs, from sediments that have been blended with reactive amendments?
Is that a question for Peggy or for me? I mean, I don't have any knowledge of that, and reactive amendments was not really the area that I was speaking about. So I hate to throw that on Peggy, but that would be one I would ask her.
Can you repeat the question?
Just whether or not there have been studies regarding volatilization of contaminants from sediments that have been blended with reactive amendments.
I have no idea.
Okay.
Maybe somebody else can answer that one.
Then another question that was submitted for Dr. Sheehan, was a question regarding whether there was no material underneath the reactive core mat. This is from John Collins from AquaBlock. It's his understanding that surface preparation was necessary for the mat and that generally a sand layer is used for a bedding material. This prevents damage to the RCM during placement.
I'm not aware of any surface preparation unless there are large voids where there may be concern that the material may tear by bridging across those voids. But I am not aware of any surface preparation that's done prior to this placement. And the nonwoven geotextile has a pretty significant strength to help bridge across minor deviations in the surface.
Okay, the next question is from Jesse Narr, an independent consultant from Minneapolis, Minnesota. What would be the approximate capital cost per square foot for the sediment area covered?
Yes, the quote that we have from 2006 is that it's with labor is $16.50 per square foot. I don't have a more current number than that, but that is the 2006 number that I have that includes labor, is $16.50 per square foot.
Okay, thank you. Another question provided from Michael McNally from ELM in Pennsylvania. With the proposed upflow test apparatus, is there an effect or has effect of potential pressure pulses from the peristaltic pump been considered? Other studies have shown that pressure pulsing can affect migration.
I think it's an excellent point, and I think it's something that we are going to monitor the volume rate that we're pumping at to try to avoid that. I think it's a great point for us to make sure we keep in mind as we move forward with those tests. The other thing I should mention is that there is a porous stone at the bottom of that device that helps with, I hesitate to use the word diffusion in this crowd, but that helps with diffusion of the pumped water so that it spreads out the flow in a more uniform way. But I think it's important for us to also not introduce these pressure pulses. So I think that's an excellent point.
Another question from Aaron Hazelton, Ohio Department of Development. Are the mats designed to stay in place? If so, is there a shelf life to the sequestration ability of the reactive layer or organic clay layer?
Yeah, that's usually the $64,000 question is how long can these stay in place and what do you do with them when they're done? They clearly have a shelf life. They clearly have a reactive capacity that is ultimately going to be reached at some point in the future. One of the things that we are working on now is to look at a biodegradable version of this where ultimately the reactive layer would stay in place, much like a clay liner would under a landfill that would provide ongoing sequestration of the sediment, but that you would not end up with residual fabric sitting there as you would now. So I think that's one of the major issues that's going to have to be addressed in the future is trying to get something that is either easily removable or becomes a relatively harmless isolation layer as you get the biodegradation of maybe the filter material. And that's, again, something that we are currently working on.
Thank you. A question from Richard Pollard, Chartis Loss Prevention. Why would pore fluids be preferentially drawn into the RCM instead of overlying water forcing its way into the RCM due to hydraulic head?
I think the only mechanism that's ultimately going to drive fluid up through from the sediment up through the RCM is going to be that surcharge layer. I mean, that's a pretty vital piece of this puzzle, is that you have to apply a surcharge to initiate those advective flows. You're also going to get diffusive flows up through the RCM because of the concentration gradient between the sediment and that overlying water. But I think I would be hard-pressed to envision a case where you would end up with downward flow because of the equilibration of the water pressure at the surface of the sediment and the water pressure in the pores of the sediment near that surface. So it doesn't mean that it can't happen. I just personally can't envision a case where that would exist.
Okay, and another internet question. We have concerns of long-term stability of the RCM mat during high flood events if it's placed in a river system. That comes from Xiaochun Zhang from the Wisconsin DNR in Madison, Wisconsin.
Do I have or they have?
Well, the question specifically, will you have concerns of long-term stability for the mat during high flood events if it's placed in a river system?
Yeah, again, I think that's a good question, and I think, like many of these techniques, the long-term viability of these mats or caps will require some monitoring and some periodic inspection to make sure they haven't been compromised. I think if they're designed properly and they're anchored properly with an overlying sediment and that anchoring system that I showed schematically early in the presentation, my understanding would be that they will be relatively secure unless there's a pretty serious event in some of these waterways. But again, I don't have experience with that, and I think it would be something that would go into the decision process of whether this was the best choice for treating an aquatic sediment in a waterway that was going to undergo fairly violent currents at any point, you know, in a 100 or however many year flood.
Well, thank you. Are there any additional phone questions that, specifically for Dr. Sheehan?
Okay, I have a question.
Please state your name and affiliation, please.
Sorry. Nestorito from Environmental Quality Board in Puerto Rico. Does a reactive core mat have the possibility that in time it may be saturated and leak to the water, the contaminant, or is it completely sealed into it, the contaminant? And react to the contaminant so it can't make any part of a contaminant go on to the sediment. I thinking in long term.
Yeah, that's the big question for us in the next phase of our research is to try to understand this breakthrough potential and ultimate capacity of these mats, because I don't think we fully understand that right now. And that's why we're moving on to this next device for these upflow experiments, is to really get a very good picture of how long these will last, what kind of capacity they actually have, and then what happens. What does happen, for example, to the concentration in the overlying water after that breakthrough occurs? How well does it sequester the sediment once it's reached that capacity? So I think that's a very good question that I hope we're going to be able to address with this next phase.
Thank you.
Any additional phone questions? Well, we have an additional question submitted on the simulcast, and it's, did you see any reduction in permeability of the mat after absorption of contaminants? Was this something you were looking for? It's our understanding that the organoclay swells as it absorbs the contaminant.
We did not see any reduction in the hydraulic conductivity of the mat during the test. Part of the reason is we saturated the mat prior to putting it into this test. Into the test device, so that it was already at a steady state of swelling by the time the test started. And we presume that that's more or less what would happen out in the field as it was being lowered into place. It would probably fairly quickly reach some sort of steady state. So while it does undergo naturally some reduction in hydraulic conductivity when it becomes wet, we don't see that in the long term because, again, it's already starting wet when this test begins.
Well, I actually have a question for you, Dr. Sheehan. Again, Carl Gustafson, Army Corps Engineer Research Development Center, and it relates to the difference between the laboratory studies and what happens when you place things in the field, particularly as you're using your laboratory studies to develop a model for breakthrough in the field. I know that, for instance, with activated carbon, you see that in the field there ends up being a lot more competition or biofouling or modifications than you see in the laboratory, and that the efficacy of the carbon for sequestering contaminants decreases once it's placed in the field. Are you trying to accommodate any of these processes in your research to evaluate and improve your models?
That's a good question, Carl. We haven't so far, and I think one of the things, I think, like Peggy, we are really anxious to do more field studies of how this works when you actually take it out to the field and get some real data from out there and observe what happens as you've observed, and I think a lot of the cap, more traditional capping with amendments, I think is probably what you're referring to. Is that correct?
It's primarily the research that I was commenting on related more to the amendments within sediment, not so much directly to sediment, not so much.
Oh, I see.
In caps.
Yeah, so I don't. Right now, we're not taking that into account. I think we're probably dealing with enough complications at this point, but I think it's something that ultimately is a good place for us to go when we deal with. We may see some of that when we do the longer-term tests with the upflow, but I suspect we won't see it till we really get out into a realistic soup out in the field where things like biofouling are much more likely to occur. So that is a challenge that's going to be ahead of us in a field trial.
Thank you. And there was a clarification on the simulcast question, and it wasn't regarding the swelling of the reactive core mat from water, rather the swelling from contaminant absorption, and whether that contaminant absorption reduces the permeability.
Not that we're aware of, no.
Okay, thank you. At this point, we are going to open up the question and answer to both presenters to have a wider ranging discussion. But before we do that, I want to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the online feedback form. On the links page, we have a series of resources that are applicable to the topic today. This is going to stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtracks, so in the near future, you're going to be able to access the slides, hear the presentation as is given today. Associated with the links page, there's an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out this form, and your comments are looked at. They are important as we continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms of this webinar. So there are links to the additional resources page and the feedback form on the last slide of this presentation. So at this point, we're going to open it up to a wider discussion for either Dr. O'Day or Dr. Sheehan. If you have any questions, please take your phone off mute. Again, *6, state your name and organization, and feel free to ask your question. Okay, without additional questions, I don't see anything else coming across on the simulcast. If we don't have any more questions at this time, you can feel free to contact Drs. O'Day and Dr. Sheehan via email with your additional questions. Their addresses are linked on the SRP Risky Learning webpage. That's on the additional resources page. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, it will be forwarded to the presenters. So thank you to Dr. O'Day and to Dr. Sheehan for the time that they took to prepare and present today and for the research that they're doing sponsored by NIEHS SRP. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you so much for all of your participation during the webinar.